Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Many rural hospitals have closed in the United States since 2010, and many more are on the brink. And when hospitals close, people have to travel farther for care. They rely on expensive emergency transportation, and sometimes they don't make it. Well, reporter Mason Adams took a close look at what's happening in communities in Virginia and Tennessee when the nearest emergency room is suddenly an hour's drive away, or when your only option for urgent care is an air ambulance that costs more than $40,000. So this hour on Point, the rural healthcare crisis. And you can join us. What's your experience with rural healthcare, specifically rural hospital care? Have you watched your local hospital close or reduce its size? And how far do you have to travel for emergency care or specialty care if you live in rural America? Join us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And by the way, a little later this hour, we're going to get an update on the Cloverlick Mine in Cumberland, Kentucky, because several months ago, we talked to coal miners there who went on strike when Black Jewel, the company that owned the mine, abruptly closed last summer and denied them their pay. So we're going to check back on what happened to the miners in Kentucky and their communities. But first, let's get to that issue of rural health care. And joining us from Roanoke, Virginia is Mason Adams. He's a journalist who's been writing about Appalachia since 2001. And his latest investigative piece on health care was published last month in the progressive magazine In These Times. His story is titled $44,000 for an ambulance and hour-long drives to an ER, the impossible cost of healthcare in Appalachia. And we have a link to it at onpointradio.org. Mason Adams, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hi. Well, first of all, I wonder if you might just describe this region that you reported on in your story. How large are the communities? What parts of Virginia and Tennessee are we talking about?
Sure. We're talking about southwestern Virginia, basically anything south and west of Roanoke, Virginia, where I'm at this morning. And we're talking about northeastern Tennessee. I kind of chose to focus in on an area covered by one particular healthcare provider, which has a majority of the hospitals. I think it has all the hospitals and a majority of the doctors' facilities in this region. It's a area that's a lot of it's economically distressed. Certainly, the counties I looked at in Virginia, I focused on one in particular in the far southwestern corner of the state. I think it's closer to several other state capitals than it is to Virginia's capital. It's bordered by Kentucky and Tennessee, two counties each in those states, and then two counties in Virginia. It's listed as economically distressed. It's got some of those Black Jewel mines mm-hmm. that you'll be talking about later. And so it's an area that's seeing depopulation. They're losing a lot of people, partly because of the coal industry and partly just because demographic trends are more people are moving for jobs to metro and suburban areas.
So as you said now, this region is served by one healthcare provider, but that wasn't always the case, right? I mean, a decade ago, there was more than one. So what happened?
Yes. Up until about 2 or 3 years ago, there were two healthcare providers, Mountain States and Wellmont. Both of them struggled. They're both nonprofits, but even nonprofit hospitals look to run what they call an operating margin, where essentially they have enough money coming back into the system to invest in new facilities. And both of these systems were struggling. I mean, their coverage area is economically distressed and losing population, older people dealing with chronic conditions, whether it's diabetes or black lung, going back to the coal area again. And it's hard for them to retain doctors. It's hard for them to offer competitive services. So they eventually filed with the state to merge, which created this current monopolistic healthcare provider.
Okay. We'll talk more about what the implications of a monopoly in a part of rural America means. But I'd love if you could just sort of take us into the stories of what the impact this is happening here. I mean, you open your piece with the story of Heather Edwards, who lives in Jonesville, Virginia, and what happened to her. Can you tell us a little bit about Heather?
Yeah, Heather grew up in that area. She actually grew up in the neighboring county of Scott County, but she lives in Jonesville, which is the county seat for Lee County. She became pregnant with quadruplets. She's considered a high-risk pregnancy. And during her pregnancy, Ballad Health, the company that operates those hospitals, the monopoly I was talking about, started looking at making some changes. And one of those changes would have been to close – or it was to close the neonatal intensive care unit at Holston Valley Medical Center, which is in Kingsport. It's across the state line, but for Heather – that was where she was going to see her doctor, and that was when she started having contractions 3 months early in her pregnancy before the due date. That was where she and her husband decided to go as well. It was about an hour's drive through windy mountain roads to get there for her. And she gave birth to her kids there, and they stayed in that neonatal intensive care unit for about the next month, 1 to 2 months. There was four of them, so they kind of got out at different times. But during that time when they were in, she was traveling that two-hour round-trip drive every day to visit her kids after dropping some of her other kids off for school and getting back in time to pick them up.
Okay. But the NICU was operating at that time, obviously, for her, and it's not anymore?
It's not. And in fact, during her pregnancy, that was one of her big concerns. In fact, she was told that they weren't going to take high-risk pregnancies at Kingsport anymore. She says that through her personal relationship with her doctor agreed to keep seeing her. So she was able to keep going there. But since her pregnancy, since she gave birth in March, Ballad chose to downgrade the hospital in Kingsport. That meant they lowered the trauma level from level one to level two or level three, meaning that they had fewer doctors on call in certain specialties. They closed the NICU. So today, if she were to have the same situation, she'd be going to Johnson City, mm-hmm. which by Google Maps says it's about an hour and 20 minutes. Based on where she lives and just the conditions of the road and traffic, she says it's closer to an hour and 45 minutes.
Wow. Which obviously in an emergency situation, every minute counts. And you've given us some tape of an interview that you did with Heather Edwards. So here she is. I mean, she told you that she worries about other mothers who may be in her situation now.
As far as now, I think it's just a matter of lives because you have all these people, you have all of these communities that go to Holston Valley. And you have all these babies that are going to be lost because some people aren't going to be able to make it another 30-plus minutes to Johnson City.
That's Heather Edwards of Jonesville, Virginia. And Mason, you also talked to someone named Danny Cook who began a protest outside the Holston Valley Hospital last May after the state approved Ballad Health's plans to close that NICU and downgrade the trauma center, like you said. You spoke with her in July, and here's Danny Cook. She expressed concern about what losing these services in these hospitals mean.
Once you have those mergers, those synergies, there's no competition anymore, right? So if somebody's not happy with their pay, where are they going? Nowhere. Right. There's no new jobs created. There's actually what they call synergies, which means we're going to, you know, eliminate different positions. There is no growth and there's no room for growth because you've got one big conglomerate. So there's no ability to grow because there's no competition. Competition is what breeds growth.
That's Danny Cook, who's been protesting the closing of a neonatal intensive care unit at the Holston Valley Hospital. So, Mason Adams, I mean, what's the way out of here? I mean, from what you're saying, the consolidation has happened to begin with because it's hard to run a financially healthy healthcare system in these rural regions.
That's right. And you know, we're in the region that I'm covering, you're talking Central and Southern Appalachia, and a lot of these states that they're part of have Republican majority state legislatures that have declined to expand Medicaid, which was a provision under the Affordable Care Act that was passed, what people call Obamacare. essentially that increases the coverage rates for Medicaid. But a lot of states have refused to cover these, and there's definitely a correlation between hospitals closing and refusal to expand Medicaid. Virginia lost two hospitals before it eventually expanded Medicaid beginning last year, and I think that was implemented this year. Tennessee, on the other side of the state line, still hasn't expanded Medicaid. They've lost 10 hospitals to closing, and I think another 15 have run in the red for 3 years of running, according to the Tennessean.
Okay. And just to stick with the individual impact that this is having on folks, I mean, part of your story is also about the big spike in bills that folks are getting. I mean, I read that from the headline of your story, $44,000 for an ambulance. What's that all about?
So I should to clarify, that's what they call an air ambulance, to be med flighted. And so there are a number of companies that operate helicopter services that work with rescue squads and ambulances to some degree. And so, you know, if someone has a heart attack or a stroke in Lee County, depending on which part of the county they're in, you know, it could be, you know, an hour and a half before they get to a hospital. It could be, you know, it just depends. And if it's extremely severe, if it's a trauma case, they'll often, if the conditions allow for it, call for a helicopter. Now, most of these helicopters aren't covered in network by health insurance companies. So the bill they'll send is, you know, $40,000 or more. I spoke to a woman in Rogersville, Tennessee, who had been med flighted because the paramedics thought she was having a stroke. She received a bill for $44,000 and change. For this air ambulance. But it really is a roll of the dice. You know, the state police in Virginia operate an air ambulance as well. And if that's the one that comes, it's absolutely free. So it really depends on which helicopter comes to get you as to what you'll be paying.
Well, we're talking about a crisis in rural hospital care in America. And Mason Adams joins us. He's been covering Appalachia since 2001, and his story is $44,000 for an air ambulance, an hour-long drive to an ER, the impossible cost of healthcare in Appalachia. And we want to hear from you. If you live in a rural part of the country, have you seen your access to hospital care change? This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast. Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about diminishing access to hospital care in rural America. And our conversation is inspired by a really fascinating article by Mason Adams. He's a reporter who's been covering Appalachia since 2001. And his piece in the Progressive magazine In These Times is headlined $44,000 for an ambulance, an hour-long drive to an ER, the impossible cost of healthcare in Appalachia. And we have a link to it at onpointradio.org. And Mason, if you hang on here for just a second, I want to turn briefly to Tony Keck. He joins us from Charlotte, North Carolina. He's Executive Vice President for System Innovation and Chief Population Health Officer at Ballad Health. And that's the healthcare system that currently operates all the hospitals in the region of Virginia and Tennessee that Mason Adams has been talking about. So, Tony Keck, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna.
So first of all, how would Ballad Health characterize sort of the changes that have happened in this region in Virginia and Tennessee in terms of people's access to hospital or specialty care?
Well, I think that's a good question. You've talked about loss of rural hospitals across the United States, and I think your next guest will talk more in detail about that. But we're actually one of the few, if any, regions where we're actually building rural hospitals. And, you know, our region, the Appalachian Highlands, Northeast Tennessee, Southwest Virginia, is about the size of New Jersey with about one-tenth the population, under a million people in this area, which is mostly mountainous. And so it's a for all the reasons you've discussed earlier, it's a very difficult area to serve. And, you know, it's important to recognize that rural health is suffering because rural communities are suffering from loss of jobs and loss of population. And our overall region shrank by about 1% over the last several years, and some counties in coal country shrank by 5 to 7%. And so, you know, under current models of healthcare reimbursement, hospitals traditionally have gotten paid to put heads in beds, which is why new models of payment like global hospital budgets under the Pennsylvania Rural Health Model are really important. And these models aren't dependent on the number of visits and admissions as population is shrinking, but are more focused on producing improved health outcomes in communities. It's also important and specific to our case to make sure that we eliminate waste in healthcare and use these dollars where they're needed most. And, you know, most of the studies agree that somewhere 25 to 30% of all healthcare spending is waste. That's over $1 trillion in the United States. And in our case, tens of millions of dollars of wasteful duplication was created by two hospital systems putting the same services across the street from each other, just simply in the name of competition. And through this merger and working closely with the state's departments of health in both Tennessee and Virginia, we've been able to eliminate a lot of that wasteful duplication and put it into areas where services haven't been available before, and put it into things that actually improve health more than healthcare services, such as transportation, housing, early childhood education.
Yeah. Well, if I may, the flip side to eliminating wasteful duplication, as you're saying, is sometimes the introduction of monopolistic price increases. So on that point, let me just get a quick call from someone who's right there in the region. David's calling from Johnson City, Tennessee. David, you're on the air.
Hello. My mother had a brain hemorrhage a few years back and had to be flown from the Bristol Hospital to UVA. And it was $85,000 for that for a specialist out of UVA because the Bristol Hospital couldn't handle it. In the past month, I've actually had a friend go to one of the hospitals in Ballard and was told they had a 95% chance of having cancer and that they needed surgery in the next 2 weeks. They drove 7 hours to Nashville, 7 hours west to Nashville, and was told, no, you don't have cancer. This is what a lot of the complaint in the region is that the service provided has dropped tremendously. And it feels to us as a community that Ballard only cares about money at this point. And that's what a lot of us are concerned about is our healthcare providers are not giving us the services that we need. And it's expensive to get that.
Right. Well, David, thank you so much for your call. And Tony Keck, would you like to respond to David?
Well, I think when we talk about eliminating wasteful duplication, I'll give you a good example. Up in Wise County, a county of about 40,000 people in the city of Norton, right in the middle of Wise County. It's about 4,000 people. There were two hospitals 2 miles from each other that were both 30% full, operated by two different systems, which, again, were operating these hospitals in the name of competition, but they were losing money. We had been able to hire 5 general surgeons between the two of us, but we hadn't been able to hire any endocrinologists to actually work on people with diabetes who end up going to general surgeons to get their feet cut off. And so the reimbursement system and the competition that was set up before was not really in the best interest of the patient. We were doing things competitively to get as much money as possible instead of trying to make the community healthy as possible. So what we're doing in Wise County now, those two hospitals that are 2 miles from each other One now is a hospital that is focused primarily on inpatient services, surgery, and emergency services. The other hospital is going to be converted into much-needed services such as rehabilitation and behavioral health rehabilitation.
Well, I take your point about that, but I mean, I think what our caller David was getting at, and in Mason Adams' reporting, there are other stories, for example, about a woman named Teresa Allgood who was getting treatments for lupus, and once she entered treatment with Ballad, the cost for those treatments went up by $10,000. I mean, there's the implication here, at least from those couple of anecdotal examples, that that the costs for individuals have risen as Ballad has had has achieved a kind of regional monopoly here. I just wonder if you could directly address that.
Yeah, and very directly, we are one of the few mergers in the United States that actually has a price cap put on us that's enforced by the states, and our prices overall cannot rise faster than hospital prices in the United States, and actually they have to rise less, and so that's monitored by the state of Virginia and the state of Tennessee, and so there may be individual people who experience higher cost or lower cost, and much of that is determined on their course of treatment. And so, for instance, we've had significant increases in the cost of our chemotherapy and specialty drugs. Every hospital in the United States has experienced this, and it's the subject of conversation in Congress right now. So there's a lot of things that are broken in the U.S. healthcare system that aren't specific to Ballad, aren't specific to our merger, but we're having to deal with. And the way that we're dealing with them is now through collaboration instead of competition. And that collaboration goes beyond just the two health systems. It goes into the community, where we've created an accountable care community of over 280 civic organizations, schools, government, church, public health providers, to actually work on the root causes of health in a community like ours. And so we've got these organizations who have committed to changing their strategies, investing their dollars, all rowing in the same direction to make sure that babies are born healthy, that mothers are born safe, that kids are ready for kindergarten, and that kids are reading at grade level and third grade. These are the things in communities that actually drive health more than healthcare services. Right. Unfortunately, in the United States, we spend most of our money on healthcare services while we spend very little on what truly improves health.
Right.
And so this model is completely different than what's going on nationally.
Tony Kick, let me just ask you one last quick question, then I know I have to let you go here, because Mason Adams mentioned this earlier, and that is that would Ballad Health advocate, or is it advocating at the state level for Medicaid expansion? I mean, that just happened in Virginia at the beginning of this year. Still hasn't happened in Tennessee. But if Medicaid expansion happened in the states that you serve, would that help tackle this problem a bit?
Well, Medicaid expansion in Virginia has definitely helped, and I'm very proud to say that our delegation in Southwest Virginia, Republican delegation, led the way in Virginia to get a Republican-led legislature to actually expand Medicaid. And that was working. We worked very closely with our delegation to explain why that was important for the region. And so we're having the same conversations in Tennessee. I'm a former Medicaid director in South Carolina, former Secretary of Health in Louisiana. Every state is very different. But I'll say Medicaid expansion is important, but it's not the only thing that's going to help rural areas. And so, you know, what's happening in Congress right now related to in reimbursements for rural hospitals, the rural health model that I mentioned in Pennsylvania, which is a new way of paying rural hospitals, these experiments by CMS are incredibly important for rural communities.
Well, Tony Kick, Executive Vice President for System Innovation and Chief Population Health Officer at Ballad Health, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Mason Adams, you heard Tony there. What's your response to what he's saying?
I mean, I can sympathize with the challenge that Ballad faces. They've cover an economically distressed, aging, sick region, but So on one hand, I can sympathize with what Tony described in terms of sort of synthesizing these two formerly competitive healthcare systems. I think at the same time, you know, they're viewing it from the top down and talking about community health and rearranging facilities in a way that makes sense for them and maybe covers, you know, what they see is the best approach for the population. But at the same time, as you pointed out, you're going to have a lot of individuals who are on the other side of that and seeing it from the individual perspective. And it doesn't always work out at the individual level. Mm-hmm. A lot of these choices don't make sense for the residents. And, you know, on top of that, I think because of that former competition between Wellmont and Mountain States, you do have residents who kind of took sides or had a bad experience with one. And now that they've merged into this monopolistic entity, you still have a lot of people who are carried over some of those previous concerns and antipathies and also are concerned about the direction they're seeing it go now and some of the changes that are happening. And the residents don't always understand why. And it may make sense from, you know, the boardroom at Ballad and from the big picture perspective, but when you're a person on the ground and you see your access going away and your costs going up, it doesn't always feel like it makes sense.
Well, I want to zoom out here for a moment and kind of get a bigger picture of how representative what you're talking about in Appalachia is, Mason, in other parts of rural America. So let me turn to Thomas Ricketts. He joins us from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. He's senior policy fellow at the Cecil G. Shepps Center for Health Services Research and a professor of health policy and management and social medicine at the UNC Gillings School of Global Public Health. Professor Ricketts, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Magna. Glad to be here.
I'm glad to have you. So how representative is Mason's story about Ballad Health in other rural parts of America in terms of people's access to hospital care?
Well, it's representative in a way that because there are mergers and combinations and system constructions of hospitals across the United States, and this is happening in urban and rural areas. But what we're talking about in that part of Virginia, Tennessee, is not unusual. North Carolina, we're having a groupment of hospitals out in western North Carolina. This sort of thing's happening out in the West. But the really troublesome thing is that this is the hospitals that are surviving, and what we're having is a whole lot of rural hospitals are closing. And that's become a problem for the communities, so that the folks around Bristol and might be a little luckier than other places because they can still have a hospital.
So can we talk about that a little bit more? Because in Mason's reporting, he points out that I believe since 2010, Mason, do I have the right number, that more than 100 rural hospitals have closed?
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. And so, and Mason described something of what sounds like this really tragic negative feedback loop, Professor Ricketts, that these hospitals are already serving a patient population which may tend towards being older and suffering particular chronic health ailments. Maybe levels of insurance aren't as high as they could or should be. Reimbursement rates are low. So that puts a lot of these hospitals in the red, and then they close, and then that makes the health of their populations even worse. I mean, is it a negative feedback loop like that?
Yes, it is. Because the background of medicine itself is becoming more technical. There's a greater need for centralization and the concentration of skills in, you know, specific places, and so that the demands on a hospital are much more intensive, both financially as well as in the human resources that have to be there. So it's harder to maintain a modern hospital in a place that has a limited economic base. So that's one of the things that's happening. The other thing that's happening is that half of rural America is expanding and becoming closer to urban America, while other parts of rural America are losing their people, they're losing their economy, not necessarily because of they're not productive. It's just that production is now much more efficient and needs fewer people, so there are people leaving rural places. This creates a situation where service sector, not just the commercial service sector, but the human service sector is under pressure because there aren't the resources to support it. So hospitals are part of that. And so we have lost 100 hospitals, over 100 hospitals in recent past. And that rate of loss has increased in the last few years. We were losing about 10 hospitals a year. We started this rural research center here in 1988 because there was concern about rural hospitals closing, and they were closing at a fairly steady clip of between 5, 10, sometimes as many as 12 a year. Uh-huh. And that's slowed down a little as we created some policies to help the hospitals. Critical Access Hospital changed some of the reimbursement in Medicare, then did some expansion of Medicaid. But then what we've had in the last 4 or 5 years is a really rapid increase, so that we had 14 close in 2013, and this year so far, 18, which is the most of any year that we had over the last 20.
Okay, well, Thomas Ricketts, stand by for a second, and Mason Adams, hang in there as well, because we do have to take a quick break. But we are having a fascinating conversation about the loss of access to hospital care in rural parts of the United States, and we'll take some more callers when we come back. So hang in there, everybody. We'll be back in a minute. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about the loss of hospital care in rural America, and I'm joined today by Mason Adams. He's a reporter who's been covering Appalachia since 2001, and he's written about this in the Progressive magazine In These Times. His story is headlined $44,000 for an ambulance and hour-long drives to the ER, the impossible cost of healthcare in Appalachia. Thomas Ricketts also joins us today. He's senior policy fellow at the Cecil G. Shepp Center for Health Services Research and a professor at the University of North Carolina Gilling School of Global Public Health. And Professor Ricketts, just briefly, because I do want to get to our callers here, you said that in the past couple of years, we've seen an acceleration of hospital closures in rural America after a sort of leveling off. What's caused that acceleration?
Well, part of it is the kind of aggregation that's into networks that you're seeing there in Tennessee and Virginia. But other is that there's something of a rationalization of systems, that there have been communities with hospitals, rural hospitals, that were competing essentially, and it just made sense to bring them together. And that's a situation you're familiar with there.
Right.
But the other situation is we've got parts of the country that really are at a tipping point when it comes to the kinds of things they have to offer as a hospital to stay open. And that's, as I said, become a very cost-intensive thing when we're expecting a hospital to have, very high-technology laboratory, operating rooms, and a full complement of physicians. To stay open as a hospital, you have to meet regulatory requirements that say you are going to have a certain minimum of services, and those are becoming less and less economically supportable.
I see. As a hospital. So I'm going to come back to that in a second, but let's go to Kenneth, who's calling from Burnsville, North Carolina. Kenneth, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm a United Methodist pastor and retired Coast Guard hospital corpsman. I live close to the Ballard Health System, and our hospital closed down labor and delivery. We don't have a surgeon after hours. Closest system is Johnson City or Ballard, and that's about an hour. But Tennessee doesn't accept North Carolina Medicaid, which means their transit is going to be plus an hour in arduous conditions in the mountains of North Carolina.
Mm. Well, Kenneth, thank you so much for your call. Another story there from the region, Mason Adams. But I want to spend a minute here, Mason, talking about some of the, I don't know if they're stopgap measures or solutions that have popped up in the region since this consolidation has happened. You talk about it. There's regional clinics now that are opening up.
Right. Well, there's some of them have been open for a little bit. There's places with sliding scales. There is one charitable organization in particular called Health Wagon that's pioneered some interesting ways. It started with a nun who used to provide health care out of the back of her VW in the coal fields of southwestern Virginia. Now they've got a couple of sites. They also provide a mobile clinic. It's generally, you know, it's pretty nurse practitioner based, which works really well for folks who have maintenance conditions like diabetes or heart issues that sort of need maintenance and regular seeing, but they don't need special services. The problem that I'm told they do run into is that they can provide those basic services, but then when they need to refer patients for more intensive care or for a specialist in particular, you know, a lot of times those patients are having to look at traveling and look at losing a day or even, you know, or more of work just to make that trip and to find that provider, which, you know, in some cases maybe across state lines, maybe, you know, all the way up to Charlottesville, which is a good 4 or 5
yeah.
hours.
Well, you also point – I'm sorry to interrupt you there, Mason, but you also point to Ballard itself. They've converted an old hospital to a different kind of facility that's got some targeted services and an ER, but isn't necessarily a hospital, so they don't have to have some of those required services that Thomas Ricketts was talking about.
Right. I guess that's the Unicoi, which is they didn't actually rebuild that hospital. They kind of built a new facility, but that's a hospital that was at risk of closing, and they built a new facility kind of with some more specialties there that seems to be getting more use than the old hospital did.
I see. Well, Thomas Ricketts, since this is an issue that seems to be touching rural communities in many parts of the United States here, I got to ask, since it's in the air a lot, would changes at the federal level, i.e., you know, Medicare for all, would that be a boon or a bane to these rural hospitals in helping them stay open?
Well, it was hard to say. You'd have to if Medicare for All had a rural component that was really focused on increasing access, it might have a positive effect. But what we don't have in America, really, we have agricultural policy, we have interstate highway policy, but we don't have a real rural social policy. If we do give Medicare for All, and all people have access to health insurance, do they have access to the health care that they need, that health insurance is supposed to pay for? Mm. And that's a question that we haven't answered nationally. Now, each state, the Medicaid programs in each state, have either make a commitment to the eligible populations that there will be certain levels of access to services, minimum access standards. But we don't have that nationally for the entire population. We don't have it for Medicare even, except under certain integrated system programs, ACOs, for example. But what we don't have is a policy that says, look, we're going to support rural America like we did when we decided that it was going to cost the same thing to mail a letter from New York to Boston as it was to rural Illinois. And we have to decide whether we are going to create that kind of rural policy that is committed to supporting the people who need to be there, who work and are productive there, but are just not there in the density that can support the kind of technological things that are required to run a modern healthcare delivery system.
Huh. Well, with that, we're going to have to wrap up. So, Thomas Ricketts, Senior Policy Fellow at the Cecil G. Shepp Center for Health Services Research and a Professor of Health Policy Management at the University of North Carolina Gillings School of Global Public Health. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Mason Adams, his latest piece in the magazine In These Times, titled $44,000 for an Ambulance, Hour-Long Drives to an ER, The Impossible Cost of Healthcare in Appalachia. Mason Adams, thank you so much for bringing us this story and for joining us today.
Thank you, Magna.
And by the way, we've got a link to Mason's story at onpointradio.org. Definitely check it out. In a moment, we're going to get an update on last summer's Black Jewel coal mining protest in Kentucky. This is On Point. Well, last July, the abrupt closure of a coal mine turned communities in Kentucky upside down. Black Jewel, the company that owned the mine, went bankrupt without warning, and more than 1,000 workers were laid off without back pay. So the miners went on strike, forming a blockade on the train tracks that are used to transport coal out of the mine. And in August, we spoke with miner Jeffrey Willig.
You know, when we first started it, we just wanted our money, our checks. We weren't nothing, asking for nothing extra. We were just like, hey, we'll leave the tracks once you pay us our money.
Well, there always seems to be a spasm of national media attention around labor actions like these, and sometimes that attention fades away. But we want to circle back and find out what's happened to the miners and to their communities as well. So Sydney Bowles joins us from Whitesburg, Kentucky. She is a reporter for the journalism partnership Ohio Valley Resource, working out of community radio station WMMT. And Sydney spoke with us last August, and she's back with us today. So Sydney, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Magna.
So let us know what happened in August, September, October to the Black Jewel miners.
Yeah, so you did a really good job summarizing how this protest got started. It really arose out of this anger among these coal miners that they didn't get paid. But the protest ended up lasting 58 days, almost 2 months. And during that time, I think it really called attention not only to the immediate financial needs of these families in Central Appalachia, but also to the larger challenges facing coal mining communities as this mono industry becomes unsustainable, mm-hmm. and these communities are left without the major employer that formerly sustained them.
Yeah. So the blockade, though, it ended up petering out after a while.
Yeah, it did. I mean, you know, these families really put their lives on hold for quite a while to hold up this blockade. And finally, after these 58 days, most people either found other work or they just found that, you know, kids had gone back to school. It was no longer sustainable to spend all day every day sitting on a railroad track. The final couple that was there was Chris and Stacy Rowe, and they ended up finding work with a trucking company. So they left on September 25th, and the protest just kind of petered out without money coming through to cover that back pay.
So they never got their back pay?
They did. They did. Payment came finally in October, months after the bankruptcy of Black Jewel back in July. And what finally happened, it wasn't the protest that finally brought about this payment. It was complicated and lengthy backs and forths between the company Black Jewel and the Department of Labor, who intervened on behalf of the miners.
So it took that intervention, you say, from the Department of Labor, and the miners eventually got their money, but only after a long time. Sydney, I wonder if you could let us know about what happened to some of the people that we talked to back in August when you were on the show. Let me just play another moment here from Jeffrey Willig, who was a miner at the Clover Lake mine. He'd been actually mining there for 11 years. And towards the end of our conversation back in August, I asked him if mining was a job that he wanted his family to continue doing for generations to come. And here's what he said.
I want my kids to go to college. I don't want them to make money with their back. I want them to make money with their mind. But that's with any job, not just with coal mining. I mean, any backlambering job.
So, Sydney, what's happened to Jeffrey since the protest has ended?
I just checked in with him recently, Magna, and he is still looking for work. But I will say, you know, other minors that were involved in this protest have gone a number of different ways. There was one guy who was working at the protest, Dalton Lewis, who he wasn't actually a black jewel miner. He worked for another mining company and was there in support. He ended up moving to Alabama for a coal mining job and was pretty immediately in a mining accident and lost the use of his legs. Other miners are still working down in Alabama. There were miners who transitioned to working for utility companies. One miner that I spent some time with, David Pratt Jr., has started nursing school.
Nursing school. Okay. So, Sydney, you've given us some tape of a conversation you had with David, who you just mentioned. You just talked to him, I believe, last Friday. And here's what he told you about what he's thinking now about mining in general in the region. And David Pratt Jr. told you that something's got to change.
Our leaders around here don't secure something for the younger generations and my generation. For that matter, this place will be a ghost town. Don't get me wrong, I'm off coal, but it's just simple facts. Mining is a short timer.
So, Sydney, is that a major change here? Because I feel like mining's always been this an industry with pretty profound ups and downs here. But even in the down moments, the presumption was that it would come back up. But has the community kind of changed its view on that?
I think this protest was definitely part of moving the needle here in coal mining communities about what the future is going to look like. But you're absolutely correct. I think as long as there's been coal mining in Central Appalachia, there's been objections to it, whether it's to the treatment of workers, the health toll that mining takes on workers, and the environmental impact that coal mining has on mining communities. So I think it is important to call attention to the activism that's surrounded coal mining for as long as it's been around. But it's also true that mining is really one of the only industries around here that can provide a decent livelihood for a lot of folks. And so it's understandable that a lot of people in coal mining communities are pretty insistent that they want coal to stick around despite all those impacts that it has. I do think, though, that even after we had rhetoric from the Trump administration about bringing coal back, there's been a growing understanding here, even among coal's most ardent supporters, that it's not going to be a stable livelihood in the future.
Tell me more about that. Is it because of, I guess it's because of a bunch of things, sort of broader changes in energy generation. Is it about the coal that's already come out of the ground there as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, mining's been going on here for a long time, and so a lot of the good coal is gone. It takes a lot more capital to get what's there out of the ground. But what we're also seeing is that in the last couple of years, cheap natural gas from fracking has become, you know, there's been a huge glut of it in the market, and renewable energy, wind and solar, have become a lot more financially viable. Utility companies recognize that. They're shutting down coal-fired power plants. They're transitioning to other forms of energy. And so the vast majority of coal in this country that was used for power generation is no longer desirable as it once was. There is still coal that's being mined for steel markets. It's called metallurgical coal. And that will probably always continue to have a fairly decent market, you know, given some ups and downs. But demand for coal overall has just taken a nosedive, and signs are that it's not going to recover.
Right. Well, Sydney, we've got a minute left to go here. I understand that another company called Copper Globe bought a bunch of mines there, and those mining jobs are still very highly paid. But as David Pratt told you, he wants leaders to secure something for younger generations. I mean, is that a common feeling in the community? Our local or state leaders, are they paying attention?
Absolutely. Going back a number of years, this idea of a just transition for Appalachia was sort of an environmentalist message or a progressive message, not necessarily in the mainstream. But I think with the promulgation of the Green New Deal and with the further decline of the coal industry, we are seeing more of an interest in a just transition for Appalachia towards other forms of energy generation and environmental or economic development that will support the whole community.
Well, Sydney Bowles, joining us from Whitesburg, Kentucky. She's with the Ohio Valley Resource, a journalism partnership out of WMMT. Sydney, thank you so much for coming back and giving us the update on what happened to those Black Jewel miners. Thank you.
My pleasure.
And by the way, if you go to onpointradio.org, you can take a look at Sydney's reporting and our show from back in August about Black Jewel. So that's at onpointradio.org. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.